It's a novel that goes back in time. It's principally set in 1900 in the town of Hopewell, Kentucky, and it goes back to maybe 10 years into the early marriage of Christy and the courtship of Christy and her husband James, and then it goes forward to 1963, so it covers a lot of ground. It's a shape of a whole life.
And it involves this extraordinary event, the birth of quintuplets.
Right, and so it's like this big event and the aftermath.
Writer Bobby Ann Mason. She'll be back in just a moment with more from Feather Crowns, her award-winning novel about the birth of quintuplets, families, and fame in America at the turn of the 20th century. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. 100 years ago in rural Kentucky, a widely held superstition involved something called a feather crown. Resembling a small bird's nest and sometimes found in feather pillows, a feather crown signified impending death or proof that someone recently deceased is in heaven. But even though the meaning of feather crowns was unclear, they did exist. That sense of uncertainty and search for meaning are pervasive in Bobby Ann Mason's third novel. It's called Feather Crowns, and it tells the story of Christy Wheeler and her husband, James. In the spring of 1900, Christy is a farm wife and mother. But that changes overnight when she gives birth to quintuplets. And because the babies are born into a turn-of-the-century world of impending apocalypse and divine judgment, Christy and James struggle to understand the meaning of their experience, a task complicated by the circus atmosphere surrounding the birth of the five babies. I asked Bobby Ann Mason to read from Feather Crowns.
Impulsively, she opened the shift robe and began searching behind James's Sunday hat for the knotted scarf she had hidden. She unknotted it and spread it out. The two crowns seemed smaller than before. A few feathers had loosened, but the weaving was unmistakably tight, like bird nests. She had heard of feather crowns in the old days. Granny Wilburn had spoken of feather crowns, but Christy had not been old enough to pay attention. Before her mother left for Dundee, she told Christy she hadn't seen any feather crowns since she was a little girl herself. If they were in a person's pillow, it was a sign the person was going to die, Mama said. But Amanda had told Christy that when a crown was found after death, it meant the person had gone to heaven. Christy had the impression the crowns were something celestial, from the Bible. The angels had feather wings, but she could not remember any pictures of angels who wore crowns of any sort. Sometimes they had halos. Sometimes Jesus had a halo. Probably the feather crowns of heaven were made of angel wing feathers, the downiest, softest feathers closest to the skin. Feather crowns had to mean something good from heaven.
Bobby Ann Mason, welcome to the National Humanities Center, and congratulations on Feather Crowns. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
Where did this book come from? What inspired it?
It was actually inspired by a true story. In western Kentucky, in my hometown, an event such as this actually occurred. In 1896, a woman gave birth to quintuplets and became world famous.
I have to ask you about the autobiographical angle. It turns out that Christy is the name of the lead character here, and your mom, is that right, is Christiana?
She has the same name as my character. I did that out of affection and because I think my mother's strength in various ways inspired my character, Christy. Uh-huh. The experiences are not the same, but I think a lot of the rural background with the kind of hardship working on a farm is similar.
How did you invent this family? Tell me about the Wheelers. We have James and Christy and the extended family. Wonderful.
Well, as I said, I based it on a true incident, but I didn't know the characters of the real people. And I had wanted, actually, my secondary inspiration, I had wanted for a long time to be writing something that would go back in time to the world of my grandparents when they were young. So it was really an exploration to try to find their lives. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having to create them, of course, because you never really know. And so the Wheelers were just what turned up in my exploration. The Wheelers are a large extended family. And James and Christy start out as a vibrant, young, sexy couple with three small children. And then they have the quintuplets, which is almost too much to bear, and certainly a surprise.
How about the research that went into the writing of Feather Crowns? We should tell our listeners that there is just an immense amount of Americana here. Clothing and food and speech, folkways. How did you put all of that together?
Well, it was really interesting, very absorbing. I should say that I didn't have to reach very far to have a real close connection with it, because I grew up on a farm in the 1940s in a world that had not changed a whole lot, except for a couple of significant things. People still seemed the same and talked the same, and their memories of the earlier time were passed along, so that a lot of times all I had to do was ask my mother, who would remember what it was like in the 20s when she was a child, and right. She would know from her grandmother what it was like earlier. So, and because the speech still survived and still survives in the oldest generations right now throughout the Mid-South, and I had heard it all my life, I didn't have to go very far to to confirm what I already knew. So just a lot of the detail was right there waiting for me to grab it and then to confirm it through through a little checking around, and then to explore a little further into a few books and old magazines and
well, again,
so
the book is Feather Crowns. It's the story of James and Christy Wheeler and the birth of quintuplets. The babies are these wonderful names: James Lake, Emily Sue, John Wilburn, Molly Lee, and Minnie Sophia. Mm-hmm. Tell me about these babies.
Well, there are five of them, and everybody keeps saying they can't tell them apart, which is what everybody would say, and they. Of course, the mother knows them from the instant they're born, or maybe even before. And so I had to create the babies as individuals, and which was hard for me since I kept getting them mixed up. But I knew Christy wouldn't.
Is it difficult, Bobby, for a novelist to write a good part of a book about five little creatures who themselves don't speak? I mean, we figure out who they are, mm-hmm. and we give them an identity in ways that are, what do you call it, non-conventional, non-traditional. Mm-hmm. They don't talk to us. How about it?
Oh, well, it's through the other characters and what they say about them. And how one is the least one, uh-huh. the littlest one,
right.
and one is the biggest one, and one cries more lustily, and one one has a little curl that makes a little top knot on her head. So there are ways of individualizing them and the things that happen to them.
What about the birth of the babies? You must have looked back at, turn-of-the-century medical manuals to figure out how, to give this, again, such an authentic sense of how this birth occurs.
Well, I didn't know a lot about birth, but I figured that not many people did know a lot about having five babies, so I had a good deal of room to imagine.
Right.
Also, I figured it would be easier in a way because the babies would be smaller, so they wouldn't cause as much difficulty in coming into the world.
Uh-huh.
but where I got going in my imagination was the pregnancy itself, where she had all these babies inside her and And she didn't know what she was carrying, and the doctors hadn't quite figured it out. And
the one doctor says it's fibroids.
Yes, and so she's ashamed and scared because there's all this commotion inside her.
Mm-hmm.
I figured if one baby kicked a lot in a pregnancy, then five babies would be terrifying. So
now, Christy takes the presents when the babies are on the way, so to speak, and then the birth of the babies. There's a lot of kind of folk magic attached to this. What does this mean, these five babies that come along?
Well, starting with the pregnancy, she's subject to imaginings about what's going on, and then I said it at the turn of the century, so most of the action takes place in 1900, so I wanted to give this sense of apocalypse and give people a reason for wanting to make something out of it. Everybody thought it meant something.
The turn of the century.
The turn of the century. That's the time when things like that really get exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a time of great superstition, and everybody looked at these miracle births in the novel as a sign of something. And so Christy, the mother, and James, the father, had to deal with this when they were, after all, just their children, their babies, and they were willing to take it quite literally, but everybody around them wanted to make something out of it.
Is this Bobby Ann Mason editorializing about the status of belief, religion, religiosity, hypocrisy even?
I think all of that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people seize on something. They want things to have meaning. They want things to be definite. They seize irrationally on things that will give their lives meaning or
mm-hmm.
pointed direction. And a lot of times there just isn't any. The superstition and the need for people to seize on something
uh-huh.
irrationally is all very negative.
You give some wonderful scenes with Christy and what is his name, Brother Cornett?
Brother Cornett.
Brother Cornett, the preacher here. And
mm-hmm.
you tie that in with geological natural wonders, the formation of a lake.
Mm-hmm.
You move, as it were, on this wonderful scale from the very general to the particular
mm-hmm.
as you touch on things like human belief and what we make of our lives.
Well, that's another element of the superstition and the reaching toward various expressions in religion to
mm-hmm.
give people's lives meaning. You're talking about a camp meeting where Christy and her friend, while Christy is pregnant, go hear this very rousing and sexy young preacher.
Charismatic, good-looking guy.
Brother Cornett.
Right.
I mean, early Jerry Lee Lewis or somebody, I'm not sure.
Well, after the babies are born, Bobby Ann Mason, again, the book is Feather Crowns, Christy and James go on tour with the babies. You're really taking our carnival culture to task here, are you not?
Well, it's really quite literal. I had the characters take a tour through the South at the turn of the century. The South was still devastated from the war, and a lot was very poor and grotesque, and they went through the carnivals and tent shows, which in some ways were more respectable than we think of
uh-huh.
from the word nowadays, but in other ways, that whole time all over the country, people were eager to see freak shows.
That's right. That's
and
right.
In a much more direct way than we allow ourselves to do now. We've
even with all of this invasive behavior on the part of the press with the O.J. Simpson story, huh?
Well, what we've done currently is to take that same desire to see, to invade privacy, and we've shifted from external appearance to people's inner lives, and we no longer find the freak shows at the carnivals,
uh-huh.
but so this need we carry to the television set, and it's more detached and clinical and distanced, so we can feel like we it's okay to do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of feeling, Bobby Ann Mason, I want you to read another passage here from Feather Crowns. And that would be, I want you to set this up for me. Here is Christy out in the woods.
In this passage, Christy identifies with something that seems to be early blues music, and it seems to express her emotions. The vegetation was dying back and walking was not difficult. Stickers clung to her dress. She watched for snakes. Eventually, she spotted the singer leaning against a tree, his back to her. He had on a straw hat and ragged blue clothing. She saw now that he had a guitar, and she could see his brown hands working the instrument. He had a bottle in his right hand, and he rubbed it along the strings of the guitar to make the whining notes she had heard. The guitar seemed to have a voice answering his song. He was singing about a woman who lived alone, a large woman in a house by the cotton fields where he worked. She was large and soft and dark as the river at night. The song didn't have any regular rhyme or rhythm. He seemed to be making up the words as he went along, the way Mittens did. But Christy began to see the woman in the song, the mighty woman coming at night to warm him in his cold bed. The memory of her carried him through the day, working in the cotton fields to get his 100. As he sang, the woman became the voice of the guitar, answering him as if she were a spirit inside that bottle. He might have been leaning onto the tree for the strength to create the extraordinary sounds. It was as if the man's mouth and windpipe were an instrument for emitting a feeling so deep down it was painful to let out. Christy crept backward. She hid behind a pecan tree and listened to the tortured song. It gave her a glow inside like an electrical bulb.
Bobby Ann Mason, the beginning of the blues. Is that what's going on in this passage here?
It's very much, very expressive, and she identifies with this this music that's coming out of the Mississippi Delta, which is then became the music I was hearing several decades later when I was a child. And
what about the issue of race? You have at least one very memorable character here, Mittens, the wet nurse. Was this race as a kind of deliberate element in your agenda as you put together Feather Crowns?
Well, I felt it probably belonged in there. It was would be a natural part of the world of the South, and I think this family probably did not have a lot of proximity and a lot of knowledge about black people. So when Mittens comes in, the women take to her instantly, and as Mittens helps out with the babies. And so there's a lot of common ground there. And I wanted to make Mittens an interesting character.
Very sympathetic.
And also I wanted to... When I took the characters through the South, they had to be aware of race relations and the situation that the blacks were in.
You have one scene in Feather Crowns where there's a public execution, or just on the heels of a public execution. Is this again? Are you rehearsing for us? Or examining our stereotypical thinking about the South, that it's a violent place. But tell me what inspired that incident.
I don't know how I would intellectualize about it. I didn't want to make it a lynching, which would have been a common thing, but it was a scheduled execution. And those things happened, and I think that those things brought out the viciousness and the appetite to witness the lurid and the sensational. And I guess I see it as just a reflection of our own time, and these things were expressed more crudely and directly than we allow ourselves to express them now in our age of enlightenment, so-called. But the same appetites are there, and we found ways to redirect them
Bobby Ann Mason, your book is Feather Crowns. How does Christie change over the course of the 60 years that you have written about? I mean, we begin in 1900 and then we end in 1963. You have an episode where Christie is the mother of quintuplets, goes to see the, how is it pronounced? The Dionne?
The Dionne quintuplets.
The Dionne quintuplets. And I take it that that's part of what's going on in this transition in this woman's life.
She lives a long life, and so she has a lot of time to try to get some perspective on the celebrity that she experienced when she was younger and was the focus of attention, like the Dionne quintuplets parents became later. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in seeing a character attain wisdom and coming to terms with an extraordinary experience.
You believe in a word like wisdom?
Oh, yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. And you impart that quality in abundance to Christie.
Yes, I think she's somebody who really wanted to understand the world and where she belonged in it and what she could do with herself.
What about the character of James, the husband? Again, you invest him with varying degrees of hostility and antipathy as he, as a male, turn of the century South, experiences what his spouse is going through. That's quite an achievement you pull off there.
Well, James is a very good man, and they have a good marriage.
Mm-hmm. They have a good sex life, and you
and
make
a very good sex.
You emphasize that. Why are you again offsetting the stereotypical thinking?
Yes, I think so. I think when I started to explore the world of my grandparents, the notion is that your grandparents couldn't have been sexy. They couldn't have been young. They couldn't have done this or that.
Right.
And so when I started trying to imagine it, I still couldn't imagine it. But uh-huh. I just had to say, well, they did it.
Right.
It had to be. Uh-huh. So I created this sensuality in Christie and James. And I think Christie had more opportunity and maybe could deal with the situation a little better than James could.
Mm-hmm.
James was a tobacco farmer, and when he was out of his element going on this long trip, he didn't know what to do with himself, and he didn't know how to figure this out. And Christie was more interested in adventure and in learning.
Well,
and
she's
in trying
also
to figure things
she's
out.
Also susceptible to the kind of guilt that not only her personal sexual
mm-hmm.
life, but this celebrity experience that she goes through, that brings to her. She struggles with that, doesn't
yes,
she?
Yes, she does. And
well, does this mean, Bobby Ann Mason, that you are critiquing our age of self-help and therapy as you examine what's going through this woman's mind?
I think I'm looking at a continuity of American experience.
Hmm.
We always think we're unique, but there are sources of our behavior in earlier times. So at the turn of the century, it's almost like a parody of today, or maybe today's a parody of then, because you look in the Sears Roebuck catalog
right.
or in the newspapers, and you find these ads for remedies and cures and it's just like we have now. I mean, things have not changed.
Well, they have different manifestations, but the impulse is still consistent.
Exactly, and cures for warts and piles and all sorts of ailments and kidney pills. And,
uh-huh.
and I mean, now we're obsessed with health, but it's not new.
Always have been. I'm going to ask you to read a final passage here from Feather Crowns, Bobby Ann Mason, but very quickly, let me ask you this. What about all the wonderful food in this book? My goodness, you could come away with practically a recipe book after reading this novel.
Well, these people are farmers. Food comes first. This is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And
have you tested all these recipes?
I grew up on these recipes. So I know this food. It's farm food, southern farm food. So the people worked in the fields. They needed huge meals to
uh-huh.
sustain them. And the women spent a lot of time preparing the meals. And
they attack them with gusto.
Oh, absolutely. And the men always eat first.
Mm-hmm.
And the women eat last. And
well,
the
that's changed.
Children. Yes.
Bobby Ann Mason, your book is Feather Crowns. I'd like you to read one more time. Here is a passage. Christie is sort of reflecting on her life.
When you've lived this long and you've survived something terrible, folks want to make something out of it. They want to know how you made out. What's your secret? "How'd you live so long?" they ask. "Whiskey and squirrel stew," some old coot will say, "and a pack a day of cigarettes." Me, I always took an interest in things. I was always busy a-doing something and trying to find out something that nobody else would think to fool with. Partly, it's just keeping a hold of your real self there inside, the same way you need to save out a little bit of sourdough for the next raising. When you're little, you notice every bird feather and little worm and pig squeal you run across, but grown folks forget to notice the little things. When you have your own children, they're part you and part not you, and then they get away from you and part of you goes with them. But you have to try to remember that part of you that's you and not them. That way, you can let them go.
Bobby Ann Mason is the author of Feather Crowns, available in paperback from Harper Perennial. Feather Crowns was a co-winner of the Southern Book Award for 1994. It was also nominated last year for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Bobby Ann Mason's other books include In Country, Shiloh and Other Stories, and Love Life. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was writer Bobby Ann Mason. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 747. That's program number 747, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. We're also interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, poet William Hayen. William Hayen will be here to read from and talk about his award-winning collection of poems. It's a book entitled The Host. In the meantime, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.